Here we go. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the House of the Rising Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And I have Bruce here, and he's in sunny California, right?
That's true.
And I'm Lynn, and I'm in kind of chilly, but still sunny Colorado. So we have had a little bit of cold weather this week. I don't know if you noticed that, but I'm sure you're enjoying the balmy air of California. While we're up here wearing our coats and vests.
Yeah, I've seen the weather reports. Anyway, yeah, lots of always things to reinforce the differences in the weather front. Huh. That's for sure, yeah.
It is pretty crazy. Well, yeah. It's always something to externalize, to look out, and to attribute my mood, my feelings, I attribute so much to what appears to be external. And, it's just kind of a crazy thing because, I'm making it all up.
Yeah,
I love
exactly,
it.
Exactly. You know what I thought would be a really wonderful, I've been very much enjoying the frequently asked questions of FACIM.org, but lesson 93, which is today's lesson for those doing the chronological from the beginning of the year workbook lessons, is just so packed. Would you be okay with this?
I'd love to do it. Lesson 93, let me tell you, lesson 93 was when I really see right in April, this time of the year, when I first started studying the course, and it's when all hell started breaking loose in my life, or it had been, it had been just like getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And then it just, I thought it was to the end, really. I was literally, and you probably can appreciate this. I had literally planned to drive my car up to Pikes Peak and just go over on one of those hairpin turns that just has the, drop to eternity. I was ready to kill myself, and I had it all planned out how I was going to do it. And a friend of mine at work said, have you ever read this book? It's new. It just came out. It's called The Disappearance of the Universe. And I said, no, I never heard of it. And, I got a copy of it and I started reading it. And that was in December. And it hadn't shifted me like that, but I certainly began to see something. And then, of course, I got the course, started doing the course, and it just seemed all lofty and beautiful and everything, but it still didn't seem to be. I was still in tremendous pain, and so I was just not getting it. But when I got to lesson 93, I was like, oh my God, this is really somebody who knows me wrote this. And when I realized how it was, yeah, it's very powerful. So yes, Bruce, would you like to start reading the lesson?
Sure. I just think there's so much to it. And this is one that Ken Wapnick has some wonderful commentary on, and I don't recall the specific audios, but I think he refers to it a number of times in different audios and books probably too. Just because it's such an example of the brilliance with which the Course exposes the disparity between the two thought systems, and a phrase that seemed like I ran across in a psychology class years ago. That's kind of a fancy $50 phrase, this, cognitive dissonance, which basically is a way of saying things aren't adding up here. there's something wrong with this picture that isn't matching, the expectations or the outcomes or the way that we expect as egos the world to work isn't happening the way we want it to. And I think that's probably what leads most people to various coping mechanisms, including, what you mentioned, thoughts of suicide. I think everybody, if they're honest with themselves, has embraced that idea in one way or another. But certainly, there must be a better way. Certainly, it takes a lot of forms, and that's a more extreme one, of course. But you know, we drown ourselves in self-medication of all kinds, and diversions and distractions and denials and you know, the whole gamut of stuff. But I think it's because we're not willing to look at the ego's, the depth of the ego's shenanigans, and but they seem like, you know, real horrific, hideous, sinister attributes that we have.
Well, exactly, and if you think that this is you, mm-hmm. this is me, then you're a pretty bad person, or you're pretty inadequate, or you're pretty awful, or you're pretty. I mean, Jesus hit the nail right on the head here with what I think I am, and it is the cognitive dissonance really is the huge factor in the problem, because we grew up our entire lives from the very beginning being told about God. That God is, talk about dissonant. You know, God loves us, and yet he's ready to throw us into a pit of fire if we, you know, don't go to Mass on Sunday, or we, you know, whatever it is that, you know, they terrify you with when you're a kid. And I mean, that dissonance is so radical that, you know, it is the shift. It's the split. Personified God of the real religious traditions is a split that is just you can't bring it together. It's unparalleled. Actually, unparalleled is the word.
Yeah, who wouldn't be terrified of a schizophrenic dude that rules over us? That's if that's what we believe in, you know. So, you know, it's not any wonder that, you know, many of us have kind of looked at, particularly in adolescent years, in my case, you know, like my mom dragged us around to a bunch of churches trying to figure out why none of them were working for her, and we pretty much exhausted every church in the Lombard Avenue Valley, I think it's at some point. And it's like, well, okay, none of these are working. So that's when the metaphysical inquiry began, and I tagged along, and it's like, yeah, because that didn't make any sense to me either. And again, that's, you know, we could spend a whole hour talking about, you know, certainly the corrections that A Course in Miracles provides to the fundamental formal Christianity that ignores the esoteric teachings that still managed to get through the editing process. Of course, the guy that in the area around Turkey the area that's north of there, north of Turkey, that where they did a bunch of the editing of the Bible to take out the stuff that, you know, they didn't like. But it was all over, I guess. Constantinople, yeah. Yeah, Constantine, yeah. Was it Emperor Constantine? Anyway, there was a whole slew of editing that
Augustine,
went on.
Augustine did a lot of stuff, too, that really threw a bunch of crap in there. But yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, go on.
Well, I'm not a biblical scholar by any sense, but anyway, I remember there's a whole lot of editing that happened. But that's kind of a symbol, and you know, the take-home lesson is that it's kind of a symbol of how we keep trying to make what is a basically conflicted thought system work, a schizophrenic God, a dualistic idea. And that's the whole core, that's the whole essence of the self that we think we are. And who wouldn't be crazy and nuts trying to reconcile those opposites? Because those opposites are made up, and that's the only way we get out of it. So the lesson starts out with the perfect contrast. The title of it is Light and Joy and Peace Abide in Me. You know, you read that and you think, oh, hey, great, man, I'm in for this really good lesson. I need something that, you know, boost that ego, right? Well, no, sorry, wrong. But the good news is that the idea is to look at that dysfunctional self-concept, a.k.a. ego, and just say, wait a minute, that's where all of our issues really stem from, is from identification with that seemingly separate self. And then he launches immediately into it. And he prefaces it with, you think you are the home of evil, darkness, and sin. It doesn't say you are. It's just you think you are the home of evil, darkness, and sin. And that's the epitome of the tiny mad idea. We think that we threw God under the bus. The real creator, of course, couldn't possibly have had that kind of a mishap. Otherwise, it would be a dualistic God. And a dualistic God, if we really, even if we try to think about it logically, it just never makes any sense. I mean, no matter how you try to.
Not a very godly God.
Yeah. It couldn't be a God of forgiveness because there's obviously some that make the grade and some that are left out. The only way that you can reconcile the difference and the duality is by thinking of a God that is one, where everything is one, and anything that isn't one is a dream, is an illusion, is a falsehood, and a ruse, a hoax, a sham, a scam, a joke.
Well, and you know, something I do want to point out here that just came to me, that this is why if I believe that about myself and I believe that God is good, then the only reason that God would ever do anything bad to me is because of it's my fault. I'm bad and unworthy. And so when we go through all these things that say, God is in me and God loves me and I'm, God walks with me and all this, I don't believe it because of this very paragraph here, this very thing right here. And I mean, I don't know if anywhere in the Course Jesus is as clear to us as about what we really think or how we really believe about ourselves as this very paragraph. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. And Ken Wapnick says, this is probably not the quote that most Course students are going to put in fancy script letters with little flowers all around it and embroider and hang on the wall or make a lovely fridge magnet, or let alone put over their front door, You think you are the home of evil, darkness, and sin, Because, or I think the way he phrases it in one of his audios is, welcome to the home of evil, darkness, and sin. Because I think that's the unchallenged assumption that wreaks havoc in our lives that we don't even acknowledge 99.9% of the time. And it's really the source of all the resistance, where when you read the stuff and then you immediately glaze over and you can't remember what you read a second ago. That's anybody listening find that a familiar phenomenon? If you're honest, raise your head high in the air, because that's our enormous resistance to looking at this, because we think it's real. We think that egoic insanity actually happened. And we reinforce it in countless ways. And because we think it's an unsolvable problem, that was one of the ideas that was to me so inspiring and refreshing when I finally got the first glimmers of it, reading completely discombobulated version of this book up in the Sierras while backpacking about 30 years ago. And I was reading that there's a difference between sin and error. And I thought, wow, that is so cool, because error is just kind of like, discovering you've made a wrong turn into a cul-de-sac. And it's like, well, no, you haven't gone over one of those things where they've got the spikes that, severe tire damage if you back up. No, there's none of that there. You just have to back up out of the cul-de-sac, put on your turn signal and turn around and, pull up to the stop sign and, make the left or the right turn or whatever and get the heck out of the cul-de-sac. But the cul-de-sac, the 3-hour tour that we thought was the whole thing, and we've stayed on ego's Gilligan's Island for how many lifetimes, is this duality kick that is just so dysfunctional and so silly. I mean, it's a joke, but we're so enmeshed in it, we don't think it's silly. We think, oh man, this is the real deal. I mean, I've got this body and I got to take care of it and I got these things to do. And sure, on the level 4, yeah, it'd be silly not to do all the things that, we think we need to do. But to not take it quite so seriously, because the correction for what never happened is just realizing that A, it never happened. And B, I was done at A.
Yeah. You don't even need A.
Yeah, but that's really kind of the nature of how, why pure non-duality is really the only way out of the dream is to recognize that it is a dream, you know? So anyway, let's actually read this paragraph. I'll start out with reading the title again of Lesson 93 and why he starts out with this lovely title, because that's really where we're headed. But we have to look at the crap that we've piled in the way, all the junk and all the detritus and this hideous thought system that we've so heavily invested in that we just, you know, we really got ourselves convinced this is truth. And he starts out again. You think you are the home of evil, darkness, and sin. You think if anyone could see the truth about you, he would be repelled, recoiling from you as if from a poisonous snake. You think if what is true about you were revealed to you, you would be struck with horror so intense that you would rush to death by your own hand, living on after seeing this being impossible. So that's the, you know, this awful, awful self-concept that if we go unchallenged and it runs unconscious like a script that has been locked away in the, you know, the mind's computer, and that's the background process that serves all the functions of our dream life. If left unexamined, no wonder we have all these things that keep happening to us that are perfectly designed to, from the ego standpoint, keep us mindless and enslaved. And yet we can use those very same scenes and lines in the script to use a different teacher and change our inner dialogue back and say, oh, this was just a tiny mad idea. The idea that I somehow messed up perfect oneness, that I was able to kill and dethrone God and put myself up there as an imposter king, that didn't happen. And we have, you know, a symbol of the Holy Spirit or the Jesus of the Bible or inner kindness teacher or whatever you want, as a guy that's just been tapping us on the shoulder gently for millennia saying, hey, you, the you that you think you are. Well, no, I don't mean the Bruce or the Lynn or whoever else is listening. I mean the decision-making mind that is aware of what the reality of this whole dream is. You, that's who I'm addressing here. And I want you to realize that you're me, actually, and you'll get that eventually. But meanwhile, you need to look at all of this stuff with a little bit less seriousness, and that lightening up will go a long ways toward revealing how the evil, darkness, and sin that we think we are the home of didn't happen. It just is a massive, massive dream, and is reinforced at every turn by the ego script, but that script can serve a different purpose, and that's where the forgiveness script comes in.
Exactly. And therefore, thereby, see, my dilemma has always been that because I was so bad, I made God punish me. You know, I, and so I'm responsible for God being an unkind being. I'm responsible for God being the one who made this whole universe of pain and death, is because of me.
So it was you, Lynn? I was blaming the wrong person this whole time.
It was me the whole time. That I changed God. I changed God. That's what I believed, whether it was conscious or not. Whether it was conscious or not. And it's like when your dad's going to spank you and he says, you know, this is going to hurt me more than it does you. And you're saying, yeah, right.
Sure.
But it's making you feel like you're the one who's caused this uncharacteristic behavior by this mm-hmm. being that is all love. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, guilt is the only thing that can come out of that. And that guilt then is what builds all of these defenses, sickness it just comes directly from this belief that I'm guilty and I deserve to be punished. And, you know, unless I look at it and see where's the guilt that is holding up, that is keeping this in place, and looking at it, to recognize that it's not valid. It's not supported. The guilt that I think I'm feeling is not supported in any way by any fact.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. And so there's no reason for God to be mad at me. There's no reason for me to be believing that I deserve to die. And when I give up that belief in, that there's a reason for me to be suffering, then that's when sickness and death really become non-entities. It doesn't mean that the body itself doesn't experience the life of the body, because that's the life of the body. You don't interfere with that. But when I'm not identified with the body as my life, then I see it as just, you know, it's going through, you know, maybe it has cancer. You know, cancer is a life form just like my liver or my lungs and has a life to live, and it just happens that it lives in people's bodies. And that doesn't make it bad. It doesn't make it unhealthy. It doesn't make it cruel. It doesn't make it anything. It just makes it, you know, no more than the tree growing in the forest and putting its roots through everything and breaking up rocks and other trees and things is evil for doing that. It's living its life.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I'm saying all these things is because people honestly identify so much with their body that they believe that the body is responsible for all of these things that seem to be happening, and they are responsible for allowing it to be. But it's just a script. Your body is no different than a chair or a mountain. Mm-hmm. It's a part of the script, and we are living out the script through that. So when you disidentify with that body and recognize your true self, then it doesn't matter what happens with the body. That's why, you know, Ken could get cancer and say, you know, well, I'm not going to go for that, you know, chemotherapy and stuff. You know, this is no big deal. And, you know, everybody made a big deal that he died. He didn't die. That was just the script in the body. And he knew that and didn't suffer because of it. Other people suffer because they believe it. So to look at the depths at which we believe we are the home of evil, darkness, and sin, to recognize that that's not true is absolutely the key to our freedom.
Exactly. Exactly. You said it eloquently. That is. I mean, that's the total key to our freedom, because seeing the fallacy of the illusion and seeing the purposiveness of it. I think that's one of Ken's gifts too, that continues to resonate today in my mind. And whenever I think of it, is that, you know, the Eastern traditions gave us the idea that the world is an illusion, and he spelled it out very beautifully. And what a great gift that is. And what, A Course in Miracles added to that was the purposive nature of it, that basically the reason that we've invested so much in a hologram of particles that you know, really are a mental creation, that even in the realm of physics, it's mostly empty space on a macroscopic and a microscopic level. If you look into, you know, deep space, there's you know, light years between galaxies and between stars, even. I mean, think of how far away it is to the nearest star in our, you know, our little tiny galaxy compared to, you know, but then the scale is just, the astronomical scale of the distances between those things on a huge level is unimaginable. And yet it's the same thing on a subatomic scale. I remember in my high school class, since I'm back in my hometown, you know, it's about 3 miles from here. I was sitting in a high school physics class, and maybe it was chemistry, and my teacher, Mr. Trimmingham, was saying, well, if you made the nucleus of an atom, and this was with the old model, even then, was still showing it was mostly empty space. He says, you know, if you made the nucleus of an atom, like a hydrogen atom, which would just be one proton, you know, the size of a basketball or a soccer ball, the nearest electron would be about 4 miles away, which is about where the Lawrence Livermore lab was, you know, or past that maybe, which is where all that physics research was done, in our local community here. And that's kind of a staggering idea that it's just not only Swiss cheese would be a very generous model, because that shows a lot of substance and a few holes, but really it's just a whole lot of nothing going on. With apologies to Jerry Lewis, you know. And that's an exaggeration, you know. It's really truly nothing. And another colleague named Nassim Haramein, who's done a lot of interesting stuff with modern physics and sacred geometry, and he's worked with a physicist named Elizabeth Rauscher, who, you know, they've studied the idea that, you know, maybe each particle, let alone, you know, the center of stars is really a black hole. You know, what if everything contains within it the seed of its own undoing? And which is basically to say that, you know, what if everything arose from a tiny mad idea and doesn't exist? Well, I mean, so even on the level of physics, there's a whole lot of things that if we contemplate them, can be a reminder of the idea of the fact that the universe was made as, and this is where physics doesn't go, as a response to a tiny mad idea of guilt, of sin, guilt, fear, death, that duality was possible. But it was purposive, and that we think that somehow we were able to pull off a separation from this perfect oneness that we would put labels like God on. And because of that, we feel terrible. I mean, not consciously, but unconsciously. And that comes to the surface every time that we feel the slightest twinge of annoyance or discomfort or suffering of any kind, as you alluded to a couple of minutes ago, when that, you know, that the suffering is purposive, because it basically keeps us mindless and keeps us from looking at the contents of the mind that might possibly suggest that it's safe to look at A and B, that if we looked at what's there, what if the foundation for that idea disappeared? What if the whole notion of throwing God under the bus is just a bogus script? I mean, we see it played out countless ways in our material world that seems to prove to us, because we think we are this home of evil, darkness, it seems to prove to us that there's something going on here. But what if it's really just, you know, this massive, massive hoax? And we've gotten so enamored with it and so entrenched in it and so taken up with the role, and we're so in character after so many lifetimes, that we've forgotten that, wow, what if the idea of being in a separate body, in a separate galaxy, in a separate, you know, thing that could possibly be separate from anything else is unthinkable. And the more that we allow ourselves to go there and contemplate the idea that it's a fraud, the more we see the humor in it and see that, you know, like Ken Wapnick in one of his later lectures says, I got this little story. It's a joke. It's this funny story. But we take it also seriously. I mean, this is, you know, the sin, guilt, fear, man. This is dark, deep, dismal stuff, right?
And we get mad when other people don't take it seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh, what's you know, what are you making fun of me for my suffering? You know.
Yeah, and obviously we don't do that. That's not the idea. But that's kind of the implied idea that, you know, somehow if we don't take ego's realm seriously, that we're you know, violating some sacred oath, you know. And, well, to the ego is sacred. Yeah. You know, just don't look at it, because, you know, if Toto pulls back the curtain, we see this, it's a sham, and it's just this little old fearful guy pulling levers and moving dials and talking into a microphone, you know, trying to keep just enough fear to keep us mindless. So, well, wait a minute. Maybe there's a, there must be a better way, as Helen and Bill said to each other.
You know, and I envision myself being like little Dorothy when I see that. You know how she gets like, "Hey, you!"
Really? The ending. Well, it's kind of like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who I got to hear years ago. You know, go through those stages of grieving. You know, we're all of us in this curriculum grieving, which is a silly idea, but that we don't really have to grieve something that's never served us, but we need to go through that process of, you know, the denial and then the anger and then the, you know, there's a bunch of stages, you know, and the bargaining and, there's a couple more stages that she identifies, but finally there's acceptance. You know, we finally realize, okay, I made this up. And from that acceptance, it comes the release. And I think that we could simplify. I that's why I like the three R's approach, is the reveal, release, and replace. And all we have to do is help and be present, be willing to do what we're asked to look at, the first two, to reveal that the ego isn't, the thought system isn't working for us, this idea of a separate self isn't cutting it, and release our investment in it and just say, okay, what if I were to let go of my identity theft, my identity attachment to, you know, this fake identity that's really robbing me of the real identity that we all share, and that's where the shared interests come in. How would I think? How would I feel? What would be different?
Yep. Byron Katie's work. Byron Katie's work does that too.
Yeah.
Very simple.
Yep.
Simple.
Exactly.
The same thing.
Turn it around. Just see what would it be like if this wasn't true. Exactly.
Bruce, I have to go and let my dog out.
Oh, okay.
Will you go ahead and start with the next paragraph?
Yes, exactly. Certainly. Okay. Paragraph 2, we're reading from Lesson 93 in the ACM workbook. These beliefs are so firmly fixed that it's difficult to help you see that they are based on nothing. Zero, zip, nada, nothing. That you have made mistakes is obvious. Now, there's again that difference between sin and error. A mistake seen from above the battleground of ego's duality is just a simple thing to undo. You just, you know, Control Z or Command Z on your keyboard, you know. How easy that is, you know. It's like, you know, nothing got permanently damaged here. Just hit the undo button. And away you go, out of the cul-de-sac, back on the road. But the sin, that's the ego's bread and butter. As long as we can be held captive by that idea of, oh man, I messed up bad. I'm in trouble big time, man. I'm going to catch hell here, because that's the ego's firmly fixed belief. That are based on nothing, you know, much ado about nothing, that we've gotten so invested in. And then he continues, that you have sought salvation in strange ways, have been deceived, deceiving, and afraid of foolish fantasies and savage dreams, and have bowed down to idols made of dust. Then there's those particles that are basically a whole lot of nothing, macroscopically and microscopically. All this is true by what you now believe. So, yeah, I mean, and it's so important to be forgiving of ourselves. And two workbook lessons from now, Ken Wapnick has a wonderful thing about the eighth paragraph of being willing to forgive ourselves for our lapses and diligence, you know, and just it calls for correction, nothing else, you know. So don't beat yourself up when you catch yourself engaging in ego script again and saying, oh, man, I really need to atone for that sin. Well, the real atonement, the Holy Spirit's atonement, is basically looking at it and seeing it disappear. The ego's idea of atonement is punishment, which is basically saying, okay, you deserve to be miserable because, by golly, you actually committed a real crime in a real world, but don't look carefully, because if you look carefully, the reality will start to crumble, just like those buildings at the deepest dream level of the movie Inception. You're just crashing into the ocean. Nothing's stopping it at that level when we're so far into the dream. You know, all we have to do is look at how unstable that is. And it's like those flats put up by hypnosis that Monty Python had. It just takes constant reinforcement. And that's the thing that ego is terrified, that we would actually spend a significant critical amount of time, reach that critical threshold where we cross over that 50% line of thinking, gee, maybe, just maybe, what if I question ego's dogma and our dogma could get run over by our karma, is to quote Swami Vivekananda. I love that one. And to see that silly ritual of believing that this world is the only thing we've got, and that, you know, dang, I must be a body because, boy, I look in that bathroom mirror and there it is again, and I keep identifying with it, and we get that reinforced over and over again. But what if we started eroding that? What if we every time we looked at a mirror said, oh, yeah, here's this dream character that's masquerading as the real self that I am. But I don't have to be upset with it. I don't, you know, obviously it doesn't help to, you know, throw daggers at it or call it, you know, dirty names. But just look at that imposter to our real identity and give ourselves a moment of humor and forgiveness and just say, I can forgive this identification that I've made as a decision-making mind with this finite self, when what I am and what everyone else is, and here's our ticket out of here, is all of spirit, as Gary Renard's Fearless Love exercise says. You know, it's we're all of spirit, not a little piece of it, and not even 99% of it. We're all of it. Every one of us is all of it. And that's pretty cool. Okay, do you want to read the third paragraph? Are you back, Lynn?
Sure. Yeah, I'm back. Yeah, the breaking loose of those beliefs. Here's something that's kind of interesting exercise to do, and I like to do it. You know, at like a conference or something, or a workshop or something, have people go on a mirror fast. Just cover up every mirror and just not look at yourself the entire time. Uh-huh. You know, what brought that to me is because, you know, I'm pretty much losing my vision in a pretty, it seems like worsening way. But I can't see the details of my face when I look in the mirror anymore, which is really kind of cool. It really is very freeing to me, because if I don't see anything wrong with it, there's nothing for me to worry about, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I realize, let's see. Oh no. The room is down. When I'm not looking at myself and thinking about myself in that way, I really don't now think about my face or how I look. Where it used to be an obsession. I used to be obsessed. If there was a reflective surface, I was looking at myself and looking for, you know, is there a zit here, or is there a hair growing there, or is there, you know, pretty serious. And, you know, it's real easy to just stop looking. It's just real easy to just stop looking and stop associating yourself with that thing. Mm-hmm. But we're obsessed with it. And so it is this whole idea of, you know, how do we get over this obsession to this world? And you were talking about the outer space going far, 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 inner space going deep, 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 all that kind of stuff. You know, what's within, what's without. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's really all in my mind.
Right, right.
So there is, and you know, someone, I think Marty Senorowski posted something about, you know, we're discovering more and more galaxies as we go along. I'm like, quit thinking about it. You're going to discover them forever.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we've got, you know, the Dark Matter University that's going to be forming to study, you know, dark matter once we, you know, build spaceships fast enough or whatever to get to a dark matter blob out there somewhere. Right?
That's hilarious.
You
that's
know, it's like
hilarious.
It's just crazy. But, you know, I think it's fun and it's interesting. But at the same time, you know, like my niece has been working on the gravitational wave laser interferometry and doing some pioneering research on that, which is kind of cool. I mean, it's fun. And at the same time, it's like, wow, what a great reminder that we've gone to these incredible lengths to make up something that is so convoluted and so detailed and so full of specifics and amazingly complex things that we could have thousands of people contributing toward an effort that finally, you know, yielded results of a few weeks ago that confirmed Einstein's theory about gravitational waves by, you know, two ground-based essentially laser interferometers that measured the difference in the speed of light at right angles to each other and corroborated that, to point to a kind of a vague region in the sky where essentially a pair of black holes collapsed in on each other, two binary objects basically collapsed and made this gravitational wave. Well, cool, but that's just one massive example of the nothingness that's pulling in. That's kind of actually a nice symbol, really, that it pulls in the nothingness to essentially collapse in on itself and wink out. Because that's what a black hole is basically a symbol of the winking out of the end product of all of ego's strategy to try to dethrone God.
That's hilarious. And
nothing happened. Nothing happened.
We predicted it and it occurred.
Yeah.
I'm just so blown away by that. When I was a little kid, I used to think that, gee whiz, every time somebody predicts something is going to happen, sure enough, it does. And every time somebody thinks of this could be in science, sure enough, they figure out it is.
Whoa.
And I thought, are we just making this up?
Isn't it amazing?
As a little kid, I think we're just making this up. We're thinking about it and it's happening.
Well, and, the self-fulfilling prophecy works. What a big deal, huh?
Yeah.
Isn't that funny how we, you know, we get so enthralled by this stuff? But, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's interesting and fun.
Oh, no, there's nothing wrong with it. No, yeah. Nothing wrong with reading a book.
Right.
To enjoy.
Exactly.
Nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong. Nothing is wrong.
Exactly.
You know, and we're just diverting our attention from our truth and our reality.
Yes.
And that's tragic. Marshall Rosenberg said that word a lot, tragic. And I think Jesus said it several times, too. Is delay in time is tragic. You know, all we're doing here is causing ourselves more suffering. So, but at the cost of, you know, giving up my grievances, which really is what happens. I mean, seriously, every single one of these things, if you think through them, what's the purpose of it? The purpose of it is to somehow or the other prove that I was right and God was wrong. And yes, absolutely, there are galaxies and universes, and there are quarks, and there are photons, and there. I mean, yes, indeed, there are those things. And yep, I was right.
We've used illusion to prove itself, right? We basically pick one illusion, say, okay, now this proves that the other illusion is real. Well, no. It's like another example of Ken's brilliance. He says, you know, that the ego is a 100% consistent, but insane thought system. So within that insanity, sure enough, you can find countless things that reinforce the dream and make it seem incredibly real and convincing, and you can touch it and taste it, and yet all those ephemeral things, when you wake up from a dream, where do they go? You know, when you stand up, where's your lap?
Exactly. That's a better question.
But I want to go back to the mirror idea. And we're probably not going to get through this whole lesson.
That's okay, because this is good.
It so. Is. It is. And I think the mirror thing is a really good one, because it really is the metaphor of a mirror, I think, is a great one, because you could use your exercise to not look at mirrors and use that with the Holy Spirit to see how the identity that you've made up and I've made up and everybody's made up, that is a seemingly separate self that can call itself a Bruce or a Lynn or a whoever, is just a crazy, crazy idea. And sure, we have to use that. I mean, you know, if somebody asks for my driver's license and you know, I pull it out, you know, there's that name, you know, there's five letters that I guess, sure, I'll you know, say that's who I am, you know, on the level of form. But on the level of spirit, not so much. And so we could use the same mirror exercise that you described, which is a really good one, actually. In reverse, we could basically we could either do it on the literal sense of, you know, just plaster mirrors everywhere. And every time we look at it, say, it says, this is not who I am. You know, or we could do it on a metaphoric level and say, everything that I look at is a mirror of the thought system that I'm choosing this moment. And if I'm feeling at peace, completely at peace, then I must have chosen. I'm choosing. Okay, you know, but that's not our experience most of the time. Which means that the mirror that's presented to us has some kind of aspect of annoyance or discord or. The least little bit of wanting something to be different is usually a clue. You know, the very idea that, well, I wish this were such and such a way. And just count the times in a minute, let alone an hour or a whole day, that those thoughts cross your mind. And including, you know, my favorite, which is, I guess, my Mars and Capricorn, you know, kind of workaholism of, oh, I've got all these fun things I'm working on. And yeah, on the level form I do. But it's easy to get into a trap of thinking, oh, well, this is going to make me happy. And, or if I get these things done on my list, you know, like yesterday I was going to get my monthly client billing done. Well, I got busy doing a web page that I was having fun with, and I didn't even hardly touch it, basically. But, you know, we make all these goals for ourselves, and so that can be a mirror. Or we can, you know, it can be about our physical form. It can be about what we think we want to achieve in the world. It can be about anything having to do with health and nutrition or, you know, the body's well-being, care and feeding of this incredibly complex mass of cells and tissues and organs that has all these, you know, complicated interlocking systems that take massive amounts of care and feeding, and you know, you have to.
I know, we're a slave.
Yeah, we have to research things to keep up with the latest health things so that we don't, you know, poison ourselves intentionally or unintentionally, right? I mean, and just let alone, you know, all the things that are threats to this little body that we've so identified with. And, you know, it, obviously, common sense says, you know, sure, do the things that, you know, make you feel safe or protected or healthy and move you away from fear. And that's why I think in Gary Renard's third book, he has a whole chapter about, you know, throw the ego a bone, you know, if it's little drops of food grade hydrogen peroxide in your water and drinking more fruit juice and, you know, there's a whole bunch of things in that chapter. They're kind of fun. You know, if those things help, why not? You know, and if you can be helpful to the people in your life you know, do things that help other people move out of fear. Why not? I mean, but at the same time, if we can just kind of look at how invested we are on the level of form with, you know, the fluids pushed through a little metal needle and the little tablets and the green pieces of paper. And you know, the course describes those things as in this sort of whimsical way of like, you really think these are going to make a difference to what the eternal self is? Come on.
It's pretty funny. Jesus is hilarious.
He is
such a joker. But of course, it was Jesus through the mind of Helen. So, you know, mm-hmm. it's Jesus through the mind of Bruce is hilarious too. Jesus from the mind of Lynn is, you know, okay. But,
oh, you've got a great sense of it.
So let's go on. Today we question this. Okay, so we've been talking about all the foolish fantasies of which we are afraid, and that that we're bowing down to idols made of dust. And, you know, these are our body, our world, our everything is really just nothing. And so today we question this, not from the point of view of what you think, but from a very different reference point from which such idle thoughts are meaningless. These thoughts are not according to God's will. And that's hugely important. If you had no other reason, okay, you're just trying to be good and do what God wants and appease this crazed God who's going to do terrible things to you if you don't, or you love him and you want him to love you.
Ego's God.
You know, whatever it is, today we're going to do something. And it's going to be, and it's going to be in accordance with God's will. And so, and God's will is much different. If I want to appease that God, if I'm so confused about God that I'm afraid of him and I have to appease him and I have to sacrifice and all that, right now it's coming up to a challenge. Okay, so if you really want to do this, if you really want to do God's will, then here's the way to do it. It says these weird beliefs he does not share with you. This is not his will. This is enough to prove that they are wrong. But you do not perceive that this is so. And why is that? Because I still think I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
Think I'm right. Yeah.
And the rightness is, it can only be a polarizing idea, because it carries with it the seed of wrongness, which is the unconscious guilt projected out to make a whole universe. And that's where, but it's merely giving form to that desire and that wish that is at odds with the will of God, which is really the perfect peace that eternal truth represents in our mind that we somehow think we left. And that's what's crazy. That's what's crazy. So the will of God, you know, again, the Course uses very intentionally uses traditional religious terms on the level of form to kind of jar us out of our Western cultural osmosis of being saturated with these kind of thoughts of the moralistic and ethical sense that somehow we think that we messed up. We think we're the home of evil, darkness and sin, because the evidence all around us that, wow, look, this is this messed up world, and there's all these, you know, just turn on TV or your computer or your phone or you know,
or anything.
Pick up a paper.
It's everywhere.
Walk down the street, and you say, oh my gosh, look at how crazy this world is. But that is just a mirror, back to the mirror of a thought system that can be turned around and, like you say, Lynn, just become a mechanism for the Holy Spirit to interpret it differently. And the will of God then becomes as this manifests in our mind, the opportunity to choose again and to choose the thoughts of forgiveness and peace that then take root and begin to grow as we look at what's crazy in the world with different eyes, and we do feel peace because we see, gee, there's nothing there that I need to be upset about. I can go do all the things that would make sense on the level of form and the level of behavior, but I don't have to invest my identity, that true identity of spirit, that of infinite spirit, eternal spirit that we all share, that couldn't possibly be tainted or polluted or cut up into little pieces and put in packages as fallible and flawed and finite as our physical bodies are. How could that possibly have happened?
Yeah.
Only in dreams.
Yeah, only in dreams. And in dreams this happens, and in And you don't question it. Mm-hmm. And Jesus points that out so many times. This happens in your dream, and when you wake up, it's gone, and you don't even question it. You know, you don't even say, well, what happened to that? Or where did that thing, you know, I had a new Mercedes or, you know.
In your dreams.
In my dreams, yeah. But I don't question, I don't go looking for it, you know, and say, who took it? I just recognize, well, it never was. And that's what he's telling us here. It's the same thing, you know. But so he says, why would you not be overjoyed to be assured that all the evil that you think you did was never done? Mm-hmm. That all your sins are nothing, that you are as pure and holy as you were created, and that joy, light and joy and peace abide in you. Your image of yourself cannot withstand the will of God. You will think that this is death, but it is life. You think you are destroyed, but you are saved. And this is it. Your image cannot withstand the will of God. So no wonder, we're just so confused. Yeah. And, you know, he's just telling us it's inevitable. You will understand this. You will get this. So, you know, that's another kind of real assurance. Even though it sounds like kind of a stern thing to say, he's saying you can't change what God made, and you can delay, but you can't stop. You know, the will of God is inevitable. So, you know, but we look at it like, not like, oh, you know, God's will is kind. We look at it as God's will is cruel. Still, the ego looks at God's will and thinks that it's cruel. And so that is what you have to look at. It's not that, oh, why don't I get why, you know, that God loves me. You have to look at why you believe you deserve the punishment and see that it has no basis. Mm-hmm. This is all he's telling us here. Look at why you believe you deserve to be punished, and then think about God and what kind of a being God is and God's will. And could you ever imagine in your right mind that God's will would be anything other than perfect happiness?
Yeah.
That would be a totally insane God.
Yeah.
So cut it out.
Kind of schizophrenic. Ego's God. Yeah, that's with a little G, huh? And as you're saying that, Lena, I was kind of flashing with you know, the Jesus of the Course is sort of like this infinitely patient but totally uncompromising dog trainer who just keeps saying, drop it, drop it, drop it. You know, because we've picked up this stick that we use to beat ourselves with, and Jesus is saying, rather than thrashing it around wreaking havoc with it, he said, oh, we'll make a game out of it. I'll throw it and you can run after it instead of, you know, terrorizing the neighborhood with the stick, you know. Maybe that's not the best metaphor, but anyway, but it's just kind of the drop it, you know, the Bob Newhart skit of stop it, you know. It's just like, all we have to do is moment to moment, give ourselves permission to just say no and just say, okay, ego, I'm not going for your denial of truth. I'm denying your denial of truth. And, I do have the capacity to say no to your no. And so it's a not no curriculum. And that no is just a simple acknowledgement that, the tiny mad I didn't happen, and our innocence, our perfect innocence, where the light and joy and peace abide, has never been touched.
Yeah, and you know, it's really cool to see in myself, and I'm sure that, you know, you see it in yourself as well, that as the time goes by, and it does take time, sadly, you know, it does take time. It took a while for us to believe this huge mistake was true. And so, you know, we really have to know for sure that it's not. And it does take time to get to that. I mean, I've been doing this since 2003. was when I got the Disappearance of the Universe.
Uh-huh.
And so, what's that, 13 years? That's freaking amazing. When I think about it, because I used to listen to people say, I've been doing this for 10 years and think, wow, that's, you got to be enlightened by now. Well, no, I realize after 13 years of doing it that it's kind of like the Grand Canyon, you know, the river runs through it and the river keeps running, but there's layers upon layers upon layers upon layers that need to be eroded away.
But it is a finite process because it's a finite system. And it's, you know, like the Course says somewhere, on you maybe you know which where the reference is, you know, our tolerance for pain may be high, but it's not unlimited, or something like that. You know, in other words, you know, eventually we're gonna, you know, like he says in the and this one I do know is it's a real alternative section in the last chapter of the text, you know, where he says, you know, perhaps you'd like to try all the different, you know, I'm going to paraphrase as usual, all the different ego options, you know, and, you know, be the first kid on your block to have tried every single permutation of ego strategy, right? But no, that's not going to work. We know it's not going to work. But eventually, we kind of catch on. We start to generalize and realize, wait a minute, this is just ego's crap again. I you know, kind of like Charlie Brown running up to Lucy's football again. Wait a minute, I know this. The wump is going to happen when she pulls it away again, you know. Damn it, why did I fall for this? But if we can catch ourselves a little bit quicker each time and be a little bit more gentle and forgiving when we catch the mind, the decision-making mind, identifying with a maladaptive solution to the non-existent problem, as Ken so beautifully said, and just say, oh, I could stop. I could see peace in this. Yeah. And I'm not upset for the reason I think. I'm upset because I chose the wrong teacher. And all I have to do is just, you know, stop mid-kick, as Charlie Brown, and just say, well, and maybe we just, you know, beat ourselves up for a shorter and shorter period of time, and that's real progress, though. That's the canyon eroding away, like you say. But it is a finite canyon, and eventually we will have, you know, exhausted our resistance, and that's the thing that is it on everyone's own time frame that we have no knowledge of, including our own. We don't know how long it's going to take us to undo that, you know, seemingly vast resistance. But it's a holographic thing. So as we look at our choice for peace or pain in every situation, and choose peace more consistently, every archetypal situation is impacted, because time and space don't really exist except in our mind. So everything, every time that we, and they're just really a kind of a placeholder for our convenience, so that we can not freak ourselves out and you know, go home instantly, because that would, like the Course says, that we'd be plunged further into terror. But if we were to just remember to slowly but surely give ourselves a little bit more slack in terms of seeing the resistance, forgiving ourselves, and then just choosing it a little less often and forgiving ourselves a little more quickly, we're doing it. That's it.
That's it. That's it. And I think we probably ought to get it going here, but you had mentioned this. It's from chapter 2, early. There's so much. The early chapters, I know Helen was not happy with them. And actually, when I look at the content of those early chapters, though, is so incredibly rich.
Yeah,
and there's, I mean, really, honestly, the things that he's saying to us in this early times is like the miracle principles. It's so incredibly rich, but you really don't understand what it is until you get later on and you've been doing the practices. But this in chapter 2, it's section 3, it's 233 if you ever want to remember it.
Okay.
The acceptance of the atonement by everyone is only a matter of time. This may appear to contradict free will because of the inevitability of the final decision, but this is not so. You can temporize and you are capable of enormous procrastination, but you cannot depart entirely from your creator, who sets the limits on your ability to miscreate. It's so funny. An imprisoned mind will engender a situation which an imprisoned will engenders a situation which in the extreme becomes altogether intolerable. Mm-hmm. Tolerance for pain may be high, but it is not without limit.
Yeah, that is.
Eventually,
there it is.
Everyone begins to recognize, however dimly, that there must be a better way. That's it.
Yeah. Thank you, Lynn, for looking that up. That was the one I was looking for. Yeah. Because, yeah, we all know that sooner or later we're going to give up this, you know, fruitless search for trying to find peace where it never exists. And we're going to just laugh and just say, wow, what was I thinking? But not beat ourselves up. Exactly. And when the self-flagellation in the mind ceases, once and for all, that's when, you know, we'll be ready for that final step. And then meanwhile, just kind of watch the process and learn to laugh a little bit more each time and forgive ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I have one quick announcement.
Oh, good.
And that is that the Weekend of Freedom Retreat, which is happening in Estes Park, Colorado, on June 16th through the 19th, which I'm very thrilled to be contributing to, not only for putting the website together, but also I'm going to share some stuff there, and I'm very much looking forward to that, along with Gary Renard, Cindy Lurie Renard, David Hoffmeister, Maria Felipe, Dove Hoffman, Dove Fishman, let's see, there's several other people. And anyway, just a whole bunch of fun stuff. That is happening, again, in Estes Park, June 16th through 19th. The facility where it's being held has rooms set aside for the conference, for the Course in Miracles conference and the Weekend of Freedom Retreat conference, which they are in less than 2 weeks, they're going to open up the rooms that have been held for the conference to the general public, and they apparently go really fast at the Spark YMCA. So for anybody who's planning to attend, the next week or so is the time to – before April 15th. So in addition to the usual tax day, there's another day you could use you could use that same mnemonic for – this is if you want to go to that conference and stay at Estes Park YMCA, that's when you probably want to snag a room before then, because once they open up to the public, apparently they go really fast because it's a very popular resort. So just to let people know who might be listening to this. And I'm very much looking forward to being there. And also seeing you, Lynn, and a whole bunch of other course friends this coming Friday in Las Vegas at the conference that the Community Miracles Center San Francisco puts on. So
that is going to be so much fun. I am looking forward to that as well. So, and we will hang out, believe me, because
yes,
not often you get to meet up with, even though you just actually literally live less than 100 miles away from me. But we don't see each other frequently either, so it'll be good. All right. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls, and thank you, everybody, for joining us this morning. Stephanie's going to be at the Estes Park thing. She's saying yay.
Great, great.
And so it's weekendofreedomretreat.org.
Uh-huh.
I did post it in the room so that, you know, people can go to the website and check it out.
Thanks.
anyway, thank you so much, Bruce. I love you.
Thank you. Likewise.
And I will send you the recording when it's done.
Have a great week.
Oh, you too, and bye-bye.